Okay, well, welcome again. There's a handout that Ben had. So if you're just arriving, make sure you get the handout. We're in a little bit of a series here in this finance class. Last week we looked at savings. This week we will be looking at investments and investing. And next week we look at retirement. And this week and next week, I'll be answering some of the questions that you folks have asked, both at the beginning of the class and as we've walked through some of this material. Next week, as part of this retirement thing, we will also look at whether it's wise to prepay on funeral expenses and what are some of the issues you need to be aware of there. So, looking forward to next week. This week, a fairly practical lesson. We want to look at some of what the Bible says about investing. But in reality, of course, most of what we've talked about all through this class with the issue of our heart and how we look at what we have or what God has given us really applies to this investing. So today's lesson will be a little bit more nuts and bolts and practical, answering some practical questions that you all have asked. And let me just say up front with this investment thing that I have no particular training in investments. Haven't gone to school for any of this like people do. Don't have any initials behind my name like all those advisors do. So if you just want to leave and drink coffee in the hall, you can, because I don't know how much all this is worth, but we'll go from there. Okay, you should have the chart or the handout in front of you. And we kind of have, last week we looked at two verses in Proverbs 18, one back to back. They form a strong contrast and a real warning to us about where our head is in this whole idea of riches. And I printed them out again on your handout. Proverbs 18:10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous runs into it and is safe. The next verse, Proverbs 18:11, A rich man's wealth is his strong city and like a high wall in his own imagination. So many people we know of are depending on their riches and what they have accumulated for their security. And we know where our true security lies. Well, when you read about Christian investing or biblical investing, it's a little bit like the issues of debt. People will pull all kinds of verses out of context to try to make a point about investing. And many of those verses simply are used inappropriately. And so I do think you have to be careful. For instance, there's a verse in Ecclesiastes that talks about spreading what you have among seven or eight people because you don't know the future. And when you read Christian investment things, they'll tell you, see, you should have broad investments over a large area. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's what the Bible's telling you. In reality, that's not what that verse means at all. It has another meaning altogether, which is talking more about charity and not about investments. So I just encourage you, as you read this stuff online or in books or whatever, go back to the source, check it out, and make sure that what the point that's being made is actually what really is there in the Bible. There are a couple verses here that I've put down that I do think fit with this concept of investments. Proverbs 27, 23, and 24, know the state of your flocks and put your heart into caring for your herds, for riches don't last forever, and the crown might not be passed to the next generation. In other words, don't take what you have for granted. Continue to work every day and manage what God has given you. Okay, do so with all your might, because you can't assume that the blessings that you have now will continue. And certainly that's true of investments. When you're in this investment game, and many people look at it as a game, you certainly really have to pay attention to every detail of what's going on. Proverbs 22:16, he who oppresses the poor to make more for himself, or who gives to the rich, will only come to poverty. And again, this deals with motivations of money. And certainly as we are investing money and trying to be good stewards of what God has given us, and investing ultimately so that we can give to others and give to God's work, we want to make sure that we're not investing in things that end up causing more problems in society. Proverbs 15:22, without consultation, plans are frustrated, but with many counselors, they succeed. And the idea here is, don't be so stiff-necked and prideful that you think you know the entire game, and that you've got a hot tip and you know exactly what you're going to do, because that's usually a recipe for failure. And so the Bible is warning about that. And of course, Proverbs 19:2, it's not good for a person to be without knowledge, and he who hurries his footsteps errs, or some translations say comes to ruin. And so the concept there is that whatever you're doing in life, you need knowledge to do it, and haste usually makes waste. Okay. So not that you should never make a move, and we do know those who would use that type of a verse to sit and in fear never take any action. That verse would lead, would encourage some people's inertia about the ability to invest because they'd be scared to lose money or whatever. But that verse is simply saying, make sure that what you're doing, you don't do in haste, trying to make a quick buck. Make sure you have knowledge about what you're doing. So with some of those verses as background, let's answer some of the practical questions that people have asked about investing. And all I can tell you is that going back to the first Bible verse there, Proverbs 27:23, about knowing the state of your flocks, I think you have to know three things when you want to do investments. You should know the marketplace. You should know the investment product, which is easy to say and very hard to do. And you should know the person who's helping you, your financial advisor. And as I mentioned, I think in the lesson on debt, when I was talking about the fact that Shelley and I had made a bad decision about someone who was supposedly a Christian financial advisor and sold us a mortgage for our home in Chester County, that the guy turned out to not be what we thought, or he didn't tell the truth about what he was selling us. And I was less cautious than I should have been because of his claim to be Christian. And so we do need to be very careful, and in our area of the country, there you can find a lot of Christian financial advisors. So one of the questions that folks asked me was, explain to me the difference of how these advisors get paid. Financial advisors kind of came on the scene in the early to mid 80s. Before that time, there was not very many of these folks around. So this concept of these financial advisors have been around for about 40 years. And when they first came on the scene, I couldn't figure out how. I was young then, but I was looking at these guys. I didn't have any money to invest, but I was just curious about this whole thing. And so I had a friend who was in this business, a Christian, and I said to him one day, and this was probably in the early 90s, probably been 30 years ago. I'll never forget his response to me. I said, I don't quite get how this all works and how these financial advisors get paid. Oh, he said, it's simple. He said, there's three people that need to make money out of investments. The firm in New York, the financial advisor himself, and you. And two out of three ain't bad. And that's often what we have learned the hard way, is that, you know, the firm in New York and the financial advisor always get paid. And then if there's money left over, you get paid, even though it's your money that they're using. So you really do have to be careful. On your handout, there are basically three ways that financial advisors get paid, these people that you go to help you with investments. And this can be someone who works for Edward Jones. This could be a bank's trust company. You know, this can be any number of types of individuals who are selling investment instruments. So there's basically three buckets that you dump people into. One is a fee-only advisor. And this type of a person will work for you either at an hourly rate or for so much money a year that you agree to, or as a percent of the investment assets of yours that they manage. These people have to operate by a fiduciary standard of care, and I've tried to define that down below for you, so that this person must always act in the best interest of you. And there's legal requirements that they do so. Now, back in the 80s, in the heady days of the 80s and 90s, when interest rates were high and investments were bringing in a lot of money, you could put your $20,000 with an investment advisor, and if they took 1 or 2% of that a year as a fee-only charge to manage your money, you weren't too upset with that because you were still making some money. But fee-only advisors have come under pressure during these last 5 years or so of very low interest rates, because unless you want to take fairly significant risks with your money, what you can get these days, because interest rates are so low, is not a tremendous amount. And so if an investment advisor wants to take 1% as their fee for managing your money, and you make 1.5% or 2%, you know, all of a sudden this fee-only thing starts to really bite or hurt. So people are interested in trying these other ways that financial advisors are paid in order to avoid that fee. But in reality, it ends up getting you, and so I don't particularly advise these other methods. Another method is commission only. This is where the financial advisor's compensation comes from the companies that are offering the financial instrument. Now, this type of a financial advisor operates by what's called the suitability standard. And the suitability standard is this concept through which I think you can drive a tractor-trailer truck that says that the advisors will sell products to the customers that they believe meets the customer's need. But it's much, much less of a definite standard than this fiduciary standard of care. So when you go to somebody who operates on a commission basis, they basically are going to recommend Well, their recommendations are suspect because they have an incentive to get you to trade more or to buy a higher commission investment product. Now, this idea of trading more, some of you know what I'm talking about there. You take your $20,000 or $50,000 or $500,000 to an investment advisor, and they invest in all these, whatever they buy, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, whatever they do. And then a year later, they'll tell you, look, the market has changed. We really think there's opportunity here. And they want you to sell a third of these things that you bought a year ago and buy new things. Well, if that advisor is a fee-only advisor, then you have some confidence that what they're recommending to you is actually true, that they see the market shifting and you should sell this portion and buy this portion. But if the person is paid by a commission, then you're very suspect because every time you buy a new investment product, they get a commission on it, no matter how long you hold it. So this person has sold you all this stuff a year ago, and now they're recommending that you sell a third of it and buy new stuff. And you're immediately suspect that the reason they're recommending that is because now they'll get a new commission on this stuff you buy this year. Does that make sense? You understand that? There would be many less variable annuities and cash value life insurance products sold if the commissions were not so high on those products. For instance, let's just look at something called a variable annuity, and I had a question on this. Okay. A variable annuity, the initial sales commission is 3-4% for the financial advisor. So, you know, if you buy a variable annuity for $100,000, which is awful large, but I only do that because that's how I can figure up here in front of you all, then they get a commission of $3,000 for selling you that. Okay, and then there still, even though they get the commission, there still is an annual management fee of 2%. Now this, I'm sure you can find a variable annuity that's different, but this is standards for the industry. So they get a 3 or 4% commission initially, and they get an annual management fee of 2%. And then, if you decide to sell a variable annuity before your retirement date, there is a surrender charge. So if you change any of the assets in this variable annuity or surrender it all to get cash to do something else, there's a surrender charge, and both the financial firm and the financial advisor share often in the surrender charge. So there's no wonder that some financial advisors who are not who do not have to operate under the fiduciary standard will try to get you to, this is the term, churn your account, which means they try to get you to buy and sell as much as possible because they get a commission or a cut every time you buy and sell stuff. So and all of this has just come more and more to light in recent years. In the 80s, 90s, even into the early 2000s, a lot of the compensation or how these financial advisors were compensated was still a little murky. And we now have more information about how some of the unscrupulous ones will try to churn people's accounts, try to steer you into things where they're getting a major kickback. Finally, then, there is the fee-based advisors, and these are very common. This advisor is compensated by commissions and also by fees that they charge to the customer. So they will sell you these kind of products. Now, for instance, just to compare here, and I am not recommending this investment product for various reasons, but many of you have probably heard that instead of a variable annuity, you can buy a no-load mutual fund. Again, I am not telling you that this is some investment thing that I like. I'm just doing this for comparison. No-load mutual funds have no sale commission. Okay, so the financial advisor doesn't get a commission from selling it to you. And most of their annual management fees are 0.5% for index funds, and I'll tell you what that means in a minute, and 1% for managed funds. So just on the basis of fees that you're going to pay, it would make more sense to buy, to invest in a no-load mutual fund than in a variable annuity. But that's only one thing you got to consider when you're thinking about investing. But I hope that explains this question someone asked about what's the difference between fee-only, fee-based, and commission. Okay. Now, real quickly, and again, I don't want to try to get into the weeds of this because you can read all this stuff ad nauseum on the web. You can go to five-hour investment training sessions and get free coffee and cookies, and you know, and they'll tell you how to do all this. I do want to tell you about this difference between an index fund and a managed fund, because this has been very interesting in the last few years as far as the results of this. A managed fund is where someone is looking very closely at particular industries. That might be agriculture. It might be pharmaceuticals. It might be healthcare, and they are intently analyzing the trends and where to invest, and in order to try to get ahead of the game, invest in the right companies in the right places, and make a bunch of money. And then there are these things called index funds. And an index fund says, okay, in the S&P 500 stock index or the Dow Jones industrial average, 10% of those stocks are bank stocks. And 20% are aerospace stocks. So all this index fund does is say, okay, hundreds of thousands of investors have given us $10 billion to invest in some Vanguard index fund. All they do is they take this $10 billion and they divide it up exactly in the same percentages as what's in these stock things. And that way they say, and these are not managed. These index funds are called passively managed compared to these actively managed funds. So all these guys are doing is they're saying, hey, we'll just buy the exact percentages of what the Dow Jones has, and therefore, if the stock market goes up 5% this year, what should our fund go up? 5%, okay? Now, these managed funds are saying, hey guys, we're smart. We got experts who are analyzing everything. The stock market might go up 5%, but because of our management and our intent laser focus on that, which of course you as an investor will pay for, we should be able to do much better than just these index funds. Think they are? Think they do? Do you think actively managed funds, for which you will pay a much higher annual, you'll pay a much higher annual fee to have your money in a managed fund compared to a passively managed index fund, do you think actively managed funds do better? Well, this is the average. From 2009 to 2013, which generally, just those years, it's been a bull market, okay, the actively managed funds outdid the passively managed funds anywhere between 14 and 40%. So in one of those years, in the last 5 years, in one of those years, yes, actively managed funds, when you look at all active management funds on Wall Street, their return was 40% greater than passively managed funds. But in some years, in 2009 to 13, an active managed fund was only 14% return higher. And your fee to have your money in an active managed fund is usually twice or 50% higher, or 100% higher, I mean, than an index fund. So the bottom line is that unless you're careful here, the idea that you're paying some industry expert to really analyze the industry, invest your money, and make a lot, doesn't really hold out year after year. Okay, so that was a question that someone asked. Any comments or questions on that? In the long run, what it's saying is that as a rule, when you compare, if you have two buckets and you put all the funds on Wall Street that are actively managed in a bucket and you put all the index funds in a bucket, you're not making out better with the managed fund. Right. And because they don't consistently return so much greater return to pay the extra expense. That's the point. Yep. Yep. These other investment instruments that are really suspect because of how much they charge, things like hedge funds that you hear about, hedge funds are notorious for their annual fees and how much they charge you when you sell what you have invested in them as the surrender cost. And this year, for those of you who, some of you who have investments probably follow the market a lot closer than I do because I don't have money in these instruments. There was a couple investor lawsuits and some big firms like Vanguard and some of those were very embarrassed by finally a strong light shone on the kind of fees that go with these hedge funds and how much money they're actually soaking their investors for. So that was something that just came to light in 2014. Okay, any other comments or questions before we move on? Okay, so my point in talking about this, well, was to answer questions people had, but also not to make you have inertia about investments. There are investment tools that you can use But it is a, when you get into this game, people will say, well, you have to invest for the long term. And that's true. But because the rapidity with which our economy changes and our industries change up and down and the tax laws change, it can make it really difficult. Something that was a benefit to you in 1 year and 5 years later can be a very poor investment. So it is something like a reminder of Proverbs 27:23, where you constantly have to know the marketplace, know your product, and have trust in who you're working with. And I don't know the answer to this because I do think that you have to go with a fee-only type of person. And for those of you who are younger and are able to put money into equity investments, which is what we call generally stocks, and take more risk, you can make money and still pay this fee and come out ahead. Where this really becomes an issue is for senior citizens who no longer want to put their nest egg in equity investments or stocks because there is greater risk of loss in the short run, and they want that money because they're older and are going to retire. So they want to start withdrawing their money equity from the stock market and putting it into safer, quote, safer investments like bonds and CDs. And we know what the return has been on those safer investments. So for our older people, this is really a hard issue, a really conundrum, because now this fee-only guy who they've worked with for 20 years, he's still charging 1% of their portfolio. So they might have $200,000 with them. This investment guy is getting 1 or 1.5% of that every year. And yet, as the person gets older and wants to have more conservative investments with much less yield, most of the yield is being eaten up by this guy, this person's fee. So it really has put older people who want to do some investing, some very conservative investing, in a difficult place in the last few years. Comments or questions? Okay, well, this is either really boring to you people or you you ask all the questions ahead of time. Yes. Yeah. And the point was, and you do have to really have an independent view of that. I mean, long ago when individual retirement accounts first came out, the idea was that you put that money away tax-free and it grew, and then you had it at retirement. And I have always felt, eventually, of course, then these Roth IRAs came out, which the difference between them was that you paid tax on the money you put in, and then when you draw it out, you don't pay the tax. And I always felt that that was just a better option, to pay the tax now, rather than have this pot of money that you think you own, but yet the government has a claim on it because they are looking at that as taxing some of that when you draw it out. So you do have to have an independent mind about some of that, David. You're right. Mm-hmm. Other comments or questions? Well, these are not the questions I feel comfortable answering, Tom, because I'm not an investment person. The municipal bonds, for people who are making a fair amount of money and therefore have a fairly hefty tax obligation to the government, they will they'll be advised by their financial advisors to look at municipal bonds because many of those don't pay federal income tax. You still have to pay state tax, but they're exempt from federal tax. So, you can buy a bond to help fund the turnpike or to fund a school district expansion in Texas or, a water system for Philadelphia or something. And, all of those bonds have ratings just like any other bond. I mean, they will evaluate whether this community that wants to float a bond is depressed and doesn't have much tax revenue or whether it's a thriving area. And therefore, usually the bond is rated better, those kind of things. So it's an area that some people should look at, yes. No, you usually get a payment once or twice a year, depending on how it's set up. Municipal bonds will often pay you a return every 6 months. But again, talk to somebody who's licensed in that kind of stuff. Yes. Okay. The question was, do I have an opinion about investing in silver and gold? And certainly we see a lot of advertisements and in magazines, and we hear a lot of advertisements on the radio about investing in silver and gold. I look at silver and gold like I do with all other commodities. I don't make anything special about that. So there's this whole idea of investing in commodities. So you can invest in a bin of corn in Iowa, and when corn was really high and ethanol was a really big deal, there were funds, hedge funds, and Wall Street types who were trying to recruit out of the College of Agriculture to get somebody who had knowledge of ag, because all of a sudden commodities of grain seemed like a really big deal. And all of a sudden soybeans got really sexy to these investment advisors, So it's a commodity. So whether it's copper or platinum or phosphorus fertilizer or corn, all of those things I look at as commodities, including gold and silver. So is there a place for investing in commodities, including gold and silver? Yes. But the issue is that typically they have been very volatile in nature. And so, you look at any commodity, and we've seen how gold and silver prices have been very variable. Generally, there's been an uptrend. So if you're in it for the long haul, probably it makes sense to have some of what you have to invest in gold or silver, or any other commodity. But for a while, copper and companies that mined copper were a very profitable investment. And as soon as China's economy pulls back, price of copper goes down. And so now that commodity's not very hot. So there's money to be made in commodities, but it's a very variable and risky thing, and I lump gold and silver in that as well. course, the advertisements that you see for it say that, they look at it like a hard asset. But if you're buying gold and silver for that, to have a hard asset, then you want to actually hold the product somehow. And many of the options to buy gold and silver is you just get a piece of paper that says you own this much gold. You don't really get the gold itself. So you have to decide which way you want to own the investment. Other comments or questions? Yes.
As a young person, mm-hmm. I invested money and we could just recognize the last and what do you have? I don't know. I just want to leave either and I said, here it is, see what you think of that. Well, tomorrow we go to talk to them.
Uh-huh.
What questions should I be asking?
Well, do you know how he's compensated? Okay. All of a sudden. Yeah. Well, beautiful. Walk in there tomorrow, sit down, and say, "How are you paid?" Well, that's the first question you should figure out is, and especially, yeah, and how are you paid with what you currently have? And especially if he starts talking to you and say, hey, there's opportunity, you really should move money into this. You want to be asking him, okay, how are you compensated? And what is it going to cost me to sell this product and buy this product? Yeah, surrender, it varies and actually can cost you up to 20% of the investment. Some of them are like robber baron in that regard. Oh, Tom, I have no idea. I have no idea on that. But those are definitely the questions you need to ask to find out before you do anything. Yeah, that's really good. Yep. But as I said, 30 years ago when financial advisors came into existence and people started putting money in, we didn't really understand the game.
Yeah, so it's like 1983.
Yeah, exactly. That, yeah. Nobody knew how this. Yeah. Yeah. Right. 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 Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes, Nancy. What was that again? Oh, you just have to look around and see, who's out there advertising as fee only. It's the best way to do it. There are trust companies who, whether they belong to a bank or whether they're a separate institution, like a lot of larger banks have trust divisions, like F&M Trust, M&T. I wouldn't recommend going with one of those big, huge chains, but they are... Hershey Trust was just bought by a larger company from Southeast Pennsylvania, but Hershey Trust has been around for years, and they will sell you instruments that are on commission, but you can also walk into these trust departments and say, I am interested in having a relationship that's fee-based only, and then that's how they'll work with you. And the banks who have trust departments like these ones I've mentioned and so on, they understand what they are under tremendous obligation with all of their clients, whether you have a loan with them or you have a CD. They understand the issue of fiduciary responsibility. So they get the weight of only advising you correctly because of that fiduciary issue. So there's one place you could start. All right, any other questions? Well, our time's up. I don't want to discourage you in this. I think as God gives you and blesses you with resources, this is an area where you can have stewardship. Just make sure you're going into it with your eyes open, knowing your marketplace, the financial advisors, and the kind of products you're buying. So let's close in prayer. Father, we are so conscious of the fact that while we sit here today and talk about this issue and this topic, that there are many millions of your children around the world who are in need of just basic food. And Father, while we you've given us a lot of resources to be stewards of, and we ask for wisdom to know how you would have us invest, how you would have us give, how you would have us care for others. And Father, we know that that you require much from us because you've given us much. And that in the end, you would find us faithful in the use of what you've given us. We just ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.